Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We made this.
Welcome to Movieversaries, an official We Made This podcast network show. I'm your host, Bo Nicholson. This is where we celebrate and sometimes re-evaluate some of the greatest films ever on a significant anniversary. On this episode, we're discussing David Lean's masterpiece, Lawrence of Arabia, considered by many to be the greatest film ever on its 60th anniversary. To help me discuss the film, I'm joined by someone who just might consider it to be the greatest ever. You might have heard of him on the Star Trek podcast, We Are Starfleet, or the Star Wars podcast, The Way, or a bunch of times on this very podcast. He's the kind of guy I would not hesitate to turn around for if I ever saw his camel riding without him. It's Ian Buckley. Ian, how are you this evening?
I appreciate that. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. It's nice and early here in Australia. Well, it's just, about clock off time for you? Where you are in your part of the world?
Yeah, it's about 5:10 in the afternoon, early evening.
I wonder what time it is in Arabia currently, where this film is based. Of course, it's Lawrence of Arabia, directed by David Lean and based on the true story of T.E. Lawrence, a British intelligence officer who aided the Arab rebellion against the Ottoman Empire in World War I. Although, if the film is to be believed, or maybe even Lawrence's memoirs, it was... largely him that did it. It stars Peter O'Toole as Lawrence himself, Omar Sharif, Alec Guinness, Anthony Quinn, Claude Rains, and Jack Hawkins. Heck of a cast. It has a Metascore of 100, a perfect 100, from 166 critic reviews. It won 7 Oscars. Ian, as you know, I'm a big Oscars guy. It won Best Picture, Best Director, Best Cinematography, Best Set Decoration, Best Sound, Best Score, and Best Editing, as well as a further 3 nominations. It's number 94 on IMDb's user-rated top 250 and comes in at equal 81st on Sight and Sound's list of the greatest films ever, right next to The Magnificent Ambersons and The Spirit of the Beehive. But Ian Buckley, I alluded to it earlier. What does Lawrence of Arabia mean to you?
Yeah, so as you said earlier, this is one of my all-time favorites, and you know, if I have my druthers, it probably won't be the last time I podcast talking about it. it's one of those movies that ever since I first saw it, sort of like Alien and Pulp Fiction, it jumped into that kind of favorites category of mine, you know, pretty much right away. And yeah, I think it's either one of the reasons I love the desert, or the fact that I love the desert is one of the reasons why I love the movie. Maybe the two are interrelated, but yeah, I've loved this movie ever since I first saw it, probably 19 years ago.
19 years ago. That places you, what, just the end of secondary school? Is that about right?
Yeah, so it would have been the end of high school. Yeah, somewhere along those lines. Again, it was one of those movies that as I was getting... You know, this is kind of a running theme with a lot of the movies we talk about on here. As I was sort of starting to look at lists of, hey, these are the great movies. And, you know, my parents were getting me into some classics. You know, this was one that I watched, you know, with them for the first time, like as a family. I think maybe one of my friends was with me too, watching it. And yeah, it's just been with me for ages. It was one of those movies that I discovered as I was discovering my love for movies. So yeah, it's always meant a lot to me.
Now tell me about that first time. It's afternoon in the Buckley household. We've whacked on a VHS, a DVD.
No, this would have been that first DVD release. I didn't see it in the VHS era. This would have been that first DVD release that it had. And, you know, at the time we had we were privileged enough to have a pretty big TV and a nice sound system that my dad loved. And we popped on this DVD and got to watch it on a pretty big home video screen, and it was great. It was, you know, the soundtrack was blasting through the speakers just the way my dad always liked it, and it was a rousing time.
Shout out to Mr. Buckley for giving you that fantastic first experience through those speakers and that great screen, because I did myself a disservice, my man. I watched it for the very first time for this podcast, which is quite embarrassing for me as a cinephile and as an Oscars guy as well. This is quite a blind spot for me. And so I've watched it, you know, of course, because it's turning 60 this year and a big movie for you. But I streamed it, or I sort of purchased it from iTunes. And I've had it sitting there for a while, because I got it when it was on the cheap. And I don't have flash speakers. I don't have a big TV, and I actually watched it in two parts. I didn't intend to. I had this very, very big grand final for indoor cricket, which was coming up in the evening, and I thought, you know what, I've got a spare 5 hours, and I don't want to think about cricket. I'm going to put on Lawrence of Arabia, and about 2 hours into it, just towards the intermission, my friend called and said, hey, I'm doing nothing before the game. Do you want to hang out? So I had to stop it at the intermission and hang out with my friend, which in hindsight was not the best way to watch this movie. And my initial reaction, Ian, you'd remember, was texting you being like, I think I said I respect it, but didn't love it. I may have said those words to you, or I may have just said that to somebody else.
Something along those lines, sure.
Yeah, and I kind of regret that, because the more I've thought about it and the more I've looked into T.E. Lawrence's life, of course, this is based on a true story, with obviously some liberal use of fantasy.
Which we'll get into, yeah.
Yeah. There is something about this movie that has really, really stuck with me, and I really, really want to watch it again if I can ever find 100 hours to watch it again. But I think it would be best if I could find it on the big screen.
Absolutely.
Which reminds me of a time that you've watched it on the big screen.
I have, yeah. This was one opportunity I got about 10 years ago, around the 50th anniversary. It had a limited re-release in theaters, at least here in the States, but I'm sure it was elsewhere too. And yeah, I called out sick from work. I think that was the first time I ever played hooky from work, and just went to a movie theater that was showing it. I was one of maybe, you know, five people in this theater in the middle of the afternoon. And I mean, the scene, the first time we see Lawrence and his guide in the desert about, you know, 18 minutes into this monster movie, you know, that scene, which I'd seen a few times, of course, by that point, literally moved me to tears, or at least close to it. You know, just the sound and the image, like the beauty of it all coming together on this massive screen, as David Lean intended. You know, nothing like it. You know, Roger Ebert says in his review of this movie, you know, seeing this movie on a big screen is, if you're someone who loves movies, you know, is one of the things you should do in your life. And I completely agree.
That's made me thirst for it even more, because there's that moment you're talking about where him and his guide are, you know, making their way across the desert, essentially. And, you know, the way the score kicks in, like as the desert comes to light, and you know, and we see the vast plains of sand, and I don't know, like that feels like the kind of moment that is supposed to well you to tears at just how beautiful it is. But on my TV, in the middle of the afternoon while I'm suffering with extreme nerves before I play a game of cricket, it was underwhelming for me. And that's a big problem. That's probably a bow issue, not a Lawrence of Arabia issue, if you feel me.
Yeah, I gotta say, underwhelming is probably a phrase that would be impossible to use to describe it if you saw it in the theater.
Does it hold up, do you think, Lawrence of Arabia 60 years later?
For sure. You know, not every element of it, as not every element of pretty much any movie that's 60 years old is going to hold up. And we'll get into specific ways in which it doesn't, but I think largely, yeah, it's pretty undeniable. And I think it also still holds up as a sort of unique film artifact that is, you know, nothing like this is ever going to be done again, ever. You know, like this kind of scale of production, of, you know, having actual real people in these actual places with large format cameras, like this is never going to happen again. And, you know, which isn't to say that stories about these people in this era can't be told in the future, and I hope they are. And, you know, particularly through a different cultural lens, it might be an interesting story to see rendered again. But like this kind of filmmaking done in this way is something that we're never going to see again. Like the industry, the film world has moved on from this era of filmmaking. So I think from that angle too, it's something that still stands to this day. You know, like Indiana Jones would say, it belongs in a museum. Like mm-hmm. if there were, you know, such a way to represent this movie, you know, like yeah, it belongs in the sort of the halls of great filmdom.
Part of the reason for that is obviously its execution, and the story it's telling is quite unique in the sense that, you know, for me outside looking in my mid-30s with pretty little knowledge of, you know, Britain's dealings in Arabia during World War One, I didn't know much about it. So my impression was, oh yeah, here we go, white savior movie. And it does, in some ways, still kind of play into that, but not exactly how I expected it to. It was a lot funnier than I expected it to be. It was, and it was more sympathetic to the Arab characters than I expected it to be as well, particularly Sharif Ali, played by Omar Sharif. But there's also the fact that they just will not, as you say, they will not make a movie where they take 1,000 extras out to the desert. they will not build the city of Aqaba, you know, just somewhere close to water, because they can't actually film in the real Aqaba. Those sort of things just do not happen anymore. And to me, I enjoy that about it. Like, I enjoy that this would have been basically an impossible film to make, and appreciate and respect it for that, for sure.
Yeah. On its technical merits, it's always going to stand the test of time. Like, it's always going to look and sound fantastic. It's always going to be incredibly edited. Like, all of the technical merits of this film will never be diminished, will never, you know, stop being worthy of appreciation. And, you know, the vast majority of the performances, I think, are going to stand the test of time. You know, the casting and some of the cultural lens that it was shot through is perhaps the stuff that isn't going to and doesn't stand the test of time as well. But as an exploration of hubris, as an adventure, as a compelling human story full of tragedy and wit, Lawrence of Arabia definitely stands the test of time. And as long as you put it in its proper historical and cultural context, it always will. Like I said, you know, we're never going to see filmmaking on this scale again. And I think everyone should, you know, kind of experience it at least once in their life.
It is worth saying at this point, and this maybe would act as a kind of content warning, sort of, that some people might find it offensive that there are white actors playing Arab characters with brown face.
As they that should. Is, they should have, yeah, a problem, like, with it.
Yeah. It is a problem and a problematic function of you know, of the time, of the era, and particularly of this movie. Alec Guinness plays Prince Faisal, of course, and you have the American actor Anthony Quinn playing Outer, of course, as well, among others.
It is worth noting Anthony Quinn's actually Mexican in heritage. So he's actually an Hispanic actor playing an Arab role, as is Jose Ferrer playing the Turkish Bey. You know, they do a fair amount of it. Alec Guinness is basically, to my knowledge, the only white person who is donning the brown face and playing an Arab character. I think it's to his credit that he plays him straight and without any kind of touch of caricature. Like, he's an actual character played as respectfully as one can while wearing brown face. It sounds absurd to say that sentence out loud. But in the context of the performance itself, it is not one where he is playing a cartoonishly offensive stereotype. That said, he obviously shouldn't be playing that role. There are many British roles that Alec Guinness could have played and didn't need to play that particular role. But this is unfortunately something that Hollywood has grappled with for decades and continues to. To use a sort of a recent example, I don't know if you ever saw, did you see Ridley Scott's Exodus like 8 years ago?
No.
Not a lot of people did. But, you know, I mean, obviously we're talking about Abrahamic mythology, but the main characters are supposed to be Egyptian. Omar Sharif is Egyptian. The main characters of Ramses and Moses are played in that movie by Joel Edgerton and Christian Bale. You were to play Omar Sharif in the movie of his life, you would have a problem if Joel Edgerton was playing him. That movie was only made 8 years ago, man. This is stuff we're still grappling with. And it's a good thing that it's changing. There is a lot of cross-racial casting that is not ideal, to say the very least. And Alec Guinness, unfortunately, as Faisal, is the biggest and most egregious example.
Yeah, absolutely. I heard that they wanted Alec Guinness to be in this movie. Of course, he was a stalwart of David Lean's previous filmography, including Bridge on the River Kwai. But he was too old to play Lawrence. That was kind of like the thing, right? So they had to go with Peter O'Toole instead, who did a great job. And we'll get into that. But they had to get him in there somewhere. And, maybe someone like an Allenby might have been a better fit. Although I think Jack Hawkins does a good job. But, you know, as it turns out, you're right. They try and do it in a culturally sensitive way. I did just want to broach the subject so that we're not ignoring it, because it's not something that we want to ignore on this kind of podcast with a couple of lefty bastards like us. But it is something that, looking back at it.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Like, the 2022 lens is harsh and unforgiving. But in 1962, the representation of the Arab characters would have been seen as quite progressive, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and in terms of the narrative and the way that they are treated and represented, you know, with the obvious exception of the casting choices with some of these characters, it still holds up pretty well. Like, this is a complex moral situation. This is not as straightforward a white savior story as one might have expected, you know, going into it without knowing much about the movie. Mm-hmm. And certainly is not one that paints the British Empire in a positive light. You know, the British Empire does not come across as particularly heroic or honorable or intelligent in this film. You know, Lawrence himself begins in a place of supreme self-confidence, which eventually inflates into until it reaches a breaking point, and then he's this broken shell of a man, no longer this, you know, this savior figure standing astride of the world, basically, at least his. And you know, he reaches a point in his journey where he's breaking down and clearly has some form of post-traumatic stress, and says to Sheriff Ali, you know, I realize we're kind of jumping around, you know, but I'm just using this as an example. You know, he tells Sharif Ali at the end, or towards the end, you know, like, yeah, I thought I was special. I was wrong. You know, like he's humbled by his experience over the course of this epic adventure, rather than coming out of the adventure feeling like he's at the top of the world. You know, he's alone and kind of broken and sad. It's a very downbeat ending to this epic story. And, you know, that's one of the ways in which it subverts expectations, but also a lot of the, you know, what would have been sort of easy and certainly typical of the era, you know, narrative tropes of pure white saviordom and rah-rah British Empire. There really is a lot of subversive stuff that still holds up to this day, I think.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. And while we're talking about themes of the film, I would like to dive into the life of T.E. Lawrence a little bit. Have you read his memoir, or have you looked into
him? I've not read Seven Pillars of Wisdom. I've dabbled a bit in some of the biographies that have been written of him and his time in Arabia, mm-hmm. but not extensively. Every time I watch this movie, I'm sort of inspired to, like, you know what I should really do? I should really crack open either Seven Pillars of Wisdom or finally one of the biographies about him. And I never end up doing it.
It's a big undertaking, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's someone, he's a curious character now that he's really on my radar. And I have done a little bit of digging into his past, like, for example, he came from privilege, to be sure, but he also was quote unquote a bastard for shorthand. Like his parents were not in wedlock. His father ran off with another woman and was not able to get married to her because of divorce rules back in the day. So he was kind of like a lord's son, but not really. There was this kind of weird balance of privilege in his life. He grew up loving knights and lords and you know, noble people. He loved the desert. He toured the desert solo for like 3 years on his own before the war. So around Arabia, which made him, you know, the ideal person to work in British intelligence when he eventually got, you know, when the war eventually started. And I mean, we're talking about a man that was, you know, potentially, it has been stated that he is homosexual, and at this time of the world, it would have been, you know, a really challenging time to be homosexual because you can't exactly come out, particularly in the military. So it was, you know, he's this complex character who, because he felt like he was a cowardly person himself, felt like he had to do these particularly audacious, brave things, which led to the events of this film, where he basically, you know, single-handedly, like, lights a fire underneath the Arab rebellion, according to the film at least, which leads to them getting to Damascus before Britain even does. And, you know, there is a lot of truth in the film. There is also a lot of fairy tale in the film as well, and some amalgamations of Arab characters and things like that. But I'd love to get your take on Lawrence the person and how he's portrayed in the film.
Yeah, it is really important to kind of separate the Lawrence the person from Lawrence the version of the person who's in the movie. You know, it's more so, I think, than even your sort of standard biopic where you're sort of expecting them to take some license and change some things. And you know, depending on how stylized the approach is, maybe they change quite a lot. And, you know, I think this movie is no exception. It's the script is based off of Seven Pillars of Wisdom, which we alluded to, which is an autobiographical accounting of a lot of his life, his adventures in Arabia. There's some doubt about, you know, whether he was always 100% truthful in everything he wrote down, whether he was sometimes using poetic, you know, license to describe certain events of his life having happened. But the broad strokes of what happens here in the desert, a lot of the specific character details are pulled from real life, but a lot of the political, you know, military stuff, a lot of that is streamlined, changed. Like you alluded to, some of the characters, you know, Ali is an invention and kind of an amalgamation of other people that he actually encountered, including Faisal himself. Faisal is real, but his relationship with Lawrence in real life was much closer, much more collaborative. He wasn't, you know, out there riding with Lawrence, but in terms of friendship, his relationship with Lawrence in real life was more like what's represented in the movie between Ali and Lawrence. Faisal maintained a friendship mm-hmm. with him after the war was over, or tried to. Lawrence kind of became a bit of a recluse and kind of shied away from meeting people from that time in his life. He was clearly very, very traumatized by his experiences in Arabia. And like you said, there's a big blend of fact and fiction in this movie, and a lot of myth making, and a lot of that is of Lawrence's own doing. You know, what's one of the themes of the movie is how he kind of builds his own myth and begins to believe a bit too much of it himself.
Well, it's not really the hero arc that I expected to come into. And then for a while there, it basically became the prophet arc. And then suddenly it became the false prophet arc by the end of the film. And I found that to be a really fascinating journey to go on. It took a little while to get there, being like 4 hours in length pretty much. But it is something that I found really, really fascinating, and something that I absolutely did not expect was the critique of Lawrence's hubris, I think, was really something that caught me off guard. And like you mentioned earlier, the critique of Britain and their tactics. One thing that I reflected on was how brilliant Allenby was, played by Jack Hawkins, somebody that was able to manipulate Lawrence's character with ease, you know, play into his ego, get him to do exactly what he wanted, almost exactly what he wanted, to the point that, yeah, sure, the Arabs got to Damascus first, but, you know, Allenby knew. He knew that everything was going to be okay. He just had to wait them out. He just had to wait it out. And then he would have Damascus himself, and then Britain would have control. He was working, he's pulling strings behind the scenes with Faisal. He was, you know, signing different treaties in different areas. Like, this guy was a master manipulator. And I did not expect that in this movie. I expected Lawrence to be the hero, Lawrence to be the one. And like you say, it really subverts a lot of those expectations.
Yeah, and you know, I always sort of think of it each time I watch it. It's a little bit less of a historical epic and more of a character epic, if that makes sense, mm-hmm. you know, since it is,
yeah.
you know, it's this adaptation of, you know, not of a biography, but of an autobiography, and even not a strictly truthful one at all times at that. And, you know, there's episodes of his life that are true, that are inserted into this movie. All of the stuff with Kasim in the desert, this man who he goes back and rescues, you know, the only change the movie makes is that apparently in real life he went back and rescued him without telling anyone. So you know, it was even kind of more crazy because, like, everyone, he just sort of disappeared and nobody knew where he went, and it turns out that he went back for this guy and rescued him. Mm-hmm. and did later have to execute him by his own hand in order to resolve a conflict as it's sort of depicted in the movie. And there was an interview that I saw with Peter O'Toole where he talks about this guy who was on set was actually there when Lawrence executed Kasim in real life, and was able to tell Peter O'Toole the story of how he found Lawrence, like, afterwards, like, curled up in a fetal position, you know, off away from where everyone was, just completely wrecked by what he had to do. And, you know, that sort of depth of character, that nuance, that complexity, all of that is infused into this movie. And, you know, it's told on this extremely broad epic canvas, but so many of these details are so human and so nuanced that I always, you know, I'm always coming back for more than just the spectacle, for more than just the grand desert vistas and the rousing music, although I'm always there for that too.
it's kind of like you get your admission ticket and just get all the treats, like, all at once with this film. And while we're on the subject of that character and the development of that character and the portrayal of that character, wow, Peter O'Toole. This was the first of his 8 nominations. He never won an Oscar, which is
ridiculous,
especially for this role. My goodness, because he was,
yeah,
he was really, really something. And, like, again, it's one of those things that the Oscars love a big performance, and this felt like a movie that was ripe for a big performance. And he has some big moments, but it's the understated work that I really like. It's the eyes. It's the, you know, something as simple as right at the start of the film where, you know, he understands Arab culture. So as soon as his guide says, "Oh, I like your gun," he's like, "Okay, well, he likes it. I should gift it to him as a friend. This is what I'll do. This is friendship in Arab culture." He gifts him the gun. The guy is, you know, so happy about that. The guide gives some food in return to Lawrence, and you can tell that Lawrence doesn't like the food, but you can also tell that he's polite. So, like, there's this split second moment where we can tell that the food's crap, according to Lawrence. You can tell that Lawrence wants to be polite, and then Lawrence pulls off the politeness so much so that the guide offers him more food and he gleefully accepts the food. And
right.
Like, just little moments like that are not of a great deal of consequence. Peter O'Toole just completely nails all those really quiet, insular, subtle, nuanced kind of moments, which I really appreciated about his performance.
Yeah, so much range in this performance. You know, these big, epic moments of grandeur, and he has to hold the screen, and those eyes, how could they not, you know, hold your attention? How could they not have inspired, you know, men to cross deserts? You know, it's all of the sort of the non-verbal, the you know, storytelling that's involved just in the performance. So good. And kind of great, you know, you're an Oscar nerd, so you probably know this, but, you know, he lost to Gregory Peck for To Kill a Mockingbird. Mm-hmm. And I believe screenplay, they lost as well to To Kill a Mockingbird. And look, To Kill a Mockingbird is great, and I like the book, and those performances are great. And as an adaptation, that screenplay, it's great. I think that, you know, Peter O'Toole got robbed I get it. It's you know, it's close. It's a great performance. But you know what? Almost every year at the Oscars, if it's a good year, you're dealing with decisions like that. And for my money, I would give that to O'Toole for sure, and I'd also give it to the script.
Yeah, it's not controversial because everyone's pretty happy for Gregory Peck.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah,
but on reflection, it does seem a bit wrong. Doesn't it? A bit wrong about Peter O'Toole, especially when we forward load the rest of history, where he got nominated for Oscars right up until 2007 and never got one. Like, he got an honorary one.
He did.
Of course. That was it. That was it, you know? And that sucks. Oh, man, it does. That sucks. But it really kickstarted his career, as it was the first Oscar for Freddie Young, the cinematographer as well. He won 3 Oscars for cinematography, all of them for David Lean epics, including Dr. Zhivago and Ryan's Daughter. The legendary editor Anne V. Coates, she kept working right up until... Do you want to have a guess what her last
it
movie
was?
It was in 2015.
It was a Twilight movie. Oh, no, it was 50 Shades of Grey.
It was 50 Shades of Grey in 2015. Gray.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And she only passed 4 years ago. She passed in 2018. Yeah, she's an all-time legend. She is, spoiler alert, one of my MVPs.
Oh, yeah, she's right up there. Can you imagine the task that she had? When you consider that a film is made 3 times, you know, obviously the writing was, you know, the adaptation, and we've talked about... bits of the writing, I think we want to talk about a little bit more of it. The shooting was just like, how do they do that? And then the edit, how did you pull that together and make it so brilliant? But also, like, just those little subtle editing choices as well. Like you mentioned, the first time we see the desert, the first time we hear that swelling score, which is also fantastic. And I think it comes from... Did he blow a candle out? Is that what happens?
A match. He blows out a match, and then it cuts right to
match, yeah.
The rising sun over the dunes, which is an incredible transition into an incredible shot where, you know, David Lean just, you know, and Freddie Young just set up a camera, and, you know, they people hadn't really shot directly into the sun in this way before, you know, maybe on a couple of occasions, but a lot of the stuff that they were doing, they kind of didn't know whether or not they were completely screwing up this film until they developed it, and they just had to kind of hope that they knew what they were doing, and fortunately they did.
Well, speaking of, like, I do want to just dive into influence of this film a little bit, because it certainly has some. Is that one thing I heard was that Anne V. Coates was one of the first editors to use the L cut, which is where you hear something before you see it, you hear it on a previous a visual before it leads to that visual eventually.
Yes.
The J cut being the reverse of that. And yeah, like little things like that. And keeping in mind, by the way, that this is all done on film. This is not digital editing, which she probably would have been doing by the end of her career for, you know, garbage like 50 Shades of Grey. But at the time.
For sure.
You know, that's having the brilliance to understand that, you know, this is going to service the story well, but just the technical ability to be able to do that. J cuts and L cuts are just, you know, just part of film now. Like, whenever I edit together something, I do it instinctively on a digital edit. It's just something that works, you know, and it all stems from people like Anne V. Coates.
Yeah, yeah. This is a way in which this movie and her work specifically developed film language that would continue to be used forever. Presumably, it's still being used, so, you know. Really, really. Her work was so pioneering and so effective. We'll get into talking a little bit more about her later when we discuss MVPs. But I can't say enough about all of the, like we said earlier, the technical aspects of this movie are completely flawless.
Mm-hmm. Are there any sort of other influences that you can think of that you can point to?
Yeah, like, you know, in general, this movie as a whole inspired generations of filmmakers, you know, people like Spielberg and Scorsese and, you know, people who went on to make other epics of their own, like Peter Jackson later on with the Lord of the Rings films. You know, there are entire generations of not just filmmakers, but also, you know, like this movie has it all. So like cinematographers, editors, actors, you know, the writers, like everything that this movie does and does well has been something that generations have continued to discover now, you know, a few generations. This movie is 60 years old. You know, people are still continuing to discover it, and it's continuing to have its influence on them.
Yeah, I'll put my hand up for that one. I just discovered it recently, and it is certainly, it's something that you can easily understand the influence would have had too. Like, it must be just such a thrilling thing to watch in the cinema now, as you said, but at the time, can you imagine being like in 1962? And I mean, there is a bit of color film going around, but there's still a lot of black and white as well. And this burst of color just like hitting you and washing over you as you know, as he explores the desert, as he, you know, is tortured, as he is, you know, as there's blood, as there's beauty. You know, the smile, the eyes, you know, a couple of good-looking men too, Peter O'Toole and Omar Sharif.
Oh, yeah.
You know, seeing them on the big screen would be excitement enough. Not many ladies to look at in the movie that I can think of.
Ann Coates is definitely the the biggest female voice in this film.
By a long shot. It's not even close. In fact, I don't think there's any actual dialogue spoken by a female character at all.
Literally zero.
I think there's some hollering at one point.
Yep, there's some ululation at the end when they're charging off out of I forget where they are now, but yeah, when they're heading out to battle towards the end, but that is it. There is no dialogue from a female character, nor is there a named female character in the movie.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I can kind of understand that. I mean, like, we're talking about a movie that was based in World War One in an Arab country, so, like, I kind of get it.
You get it, right. It's you know, like, I haven't seen it, and there probably are, because I would imagine, you know, the Western Front's a little bit different, but in the movie 1917, I can't imagine there are a ton of female roles in that. Maybe I'm wrong. Like I said, I haven't seen it, but like, I wouldn't be surprised if a movie that took place in World War One just didn't have a lot of female roles to go around.
Yeah, come to think of it, I can't think of any either. There might be like a nurse.
The only thing I was thinking, but yeah, there isn't even that here. Nothing.
Yeah, interesting. We spoke a little bit about the shortcomings of, you know, the representation of Prince Faisal's character particularly, but some of the other Arab characters as well with brown face or, you know, different things. Are there any other shortcomings, or is this movie basically perfect apart from, you know, the 2022 lens?
Well, I don't think it has to be, you know, flawless to be something that's you know, what I would call perfect. You know, I would say this is a perfect movie, even though I would be able to list a bunch of flaws that it has, like we've talked about. I can't off the top of my head think of anything else that we haven't already gone into some detail about, you know, the representation being, and the casting being the biggest thing that today you look back on and are like, that's the only thing that comes close to, you know, kind of bumping me as I watched the movie. And, you know, it would bump me more if Alec Guinness had made a more caricatured performance, if it wasn't a character that was portrayed with some degree of sensitivity, again, in the context of a brown face performance. You know, it was more or less sensitively portrayed. So, Not really. There aren't a lot that stand out. You know, I know a lot of people are intimidated by the length. For me, and again, I'm obviously biased because I love the movie, but I don't really feel the length so much on this one. I think that's a testament to how well edited it is, but also just the propulsive nature of the storytelling, and even the moments where the movie is taking its time. You know, ideally, at least I am when I'm watching it, you're captivated by the images and sounds that are being presented. You know, yeah, you're spending minutes at a time wandering in the desert and there's no dialogue, but look at it. Look at what's goddamn happening on the screen. It's incredible. And you're feeling the heat radiating out of. This is another thing, too, that is especially noticeable when you see it on the big screen. You know, the heat somehow is coming off that screen and you can feel it. You know, you can see how much desert there is because they're being shown on this enormous canvas of sand, and it's all stretching out everywhere around them. And you know, you take your time with how everything's unfolding, but it never feels to me like it's dragging or like it's slow or like I'm like, boy, when is the next thing going to happen? There's always something interesting to me happening on the screen.
And a lot of that comes down to the writing, and let's talk about that a little bit, because that is somewhere that my expectations were subverted, or at least exceeded my expectations, because I expected something a bit drier, for sure. It was a lot wittier than I expected. They started with his death, which I thought was very interesting, especially that wonderful shot looking down upon the motorbike with the title of the movie in the corner. Oh, man, I love that shot. There's something like, in a movie of very impressive shots, that was something that really struck me, and I think it was because I didn't expect it. I expected desert, and then I got motorbike, and I'm like, oh, this is interesting. And not knowing how T. Lawrence died, I didn't know what was happening next. But the writing of it is fantastic, and it's so interesting that, you know, like when you really think about it, Act One ends in Aqaba.
Yeah.
Which is like an hour and 50 minutes into this movie. But there's a lot of stuff that's like rising and falling within that first act, which is a bit unusual. So it's strange. Like, I think of, like, you know, the most obvious comparison I can make in terms of length, in terms of scope and things like that is The Seven Samurai, right? And that first act takes about an hour and 10 minutes. And that ends when, you know, they have the team and they're heading back to the village. But that's, you know, the rise and fall in that, it could not be its own movie, I don't think. That first act of Seven Samurai. I feel like the capture of Aqaba could be the end of a very good movie.
Sure.
With Lawrence of Arabia. Like, that first act could be a movie unto itself. The way that it rises and falls, the way that you have a character arc for a bunch of people, it would have been a very different movie, and it's inferior to the total product. But I think it still would be a very, very good movie on its own.
Yeah.
Which is just very unusual when you think about it.
Yeah, for sure. I'm actually glad you brought up Seven Samurai. I haven't gotten to see that recently in the theaters. I'll say that's a movie where I felt its length much more so than I typically do when I'm watching this one, for whatever reason. And I hear what you're saying. I think that there's a lot of, even though the story in Lawrence is pretty simple, pretty straightforward, like there's some somewhat complicated political machinations kind of happening in the background of these events. But that's mostly kind of off to the side. The basic story of what's happening in any given scene is pretty straightforward, pretty easy to understand. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's such an easy watch, is it isn't one of these kind of overstuffed epics where you have a ton of different plot points that you've got to keep track of and a ton of different characters here, there, and everywhere that you've got to keep track of and all these overlapping storylines. There's really just kind of one thing going, you know, going on at a time. There's a lot of different things that happen in, over the course of the movie, but only a couple of them are happening at once. And I think that keeps things moving as well, and I think it keeps you engaged as well, despite the runtime.
I think you talk about things that are happening at the same time, or only a couple of things that are going on. I actually had a different impression of things. Like, yeah, what we're being presented on the screen is, yeah, very focused and all that sort of stuff. But it was the lingering impact of the words of Allenby or Dryden, played by the wonderful Claude Rains, that, you know, like, as particularly when it gets to this Act 2, Act 3, the second half of the film, after the intermission, it's the behavior of some of these men and the manipulation of Lawrence and then the degradation of Lawrence's psyche that, you know, while we're being presented with one thing on the screen, in the back of my mind was all this work that was going on, just being like, oh yeah, no, this is because Allenby has set this up and this exact situation is exactly what Allenby wants, but he would never say it. And I was like, I was consuming the movie in, it sounds like a slightly different way, but it was still really working for me in that way. You know, the fact that it had, I think the only way to describe it is like a layer there that a lot of movies just don't have, which was the way that it used its political characters to set like a separate story in motion in the background that only really, really, truly reveals itself in Damascus, I feel. And that's something that I found just, you know, again, credit to the writers, one of which was blacklisted, I believe. Who were the writers? It was Robert Bolt who got the credit for it, and Michael Wilson was the blacklisted one who eventually got the credit after a fair bit of time. Yeah, fair bit of credit to them, because being able to juggle those political machinations behind this epic story, behind this character study of this man, is something that I was absolutely floored by, to be honest.
Yeah, a lot of credit to them. And, you know, again, well, I'm going to jump ahead. For once, when we give out the MVP award, I will not be giving it to the director. But I am going to give it to the writers and an editor. I'm going to kind of co-MVP. Basically because, you know, like you were alluding to, there's so much stuff going on in this script, and, you know, to adapt this weighty, really dense, literate tome that T.E. Lawrence produced in The Seven Pillars of Wisdom and turn that into this, is mm-hmm. an incredible mm-hmm. achievement of screenwriting and adaptation. And I, you know, again, I think the fact that it is as witty as it is, kind of like you said, unexpectedly, like you don't expect this movie to be as funny as it is and as insightful as it is and as subversive of the kind of like the easy savior tropes, the easy hero tropes that this movie could have fallen into. It subverts basically all of those, almost all of them, and it, you know, does so in a way that, like, I, you know, every time I watch this, I'm cracking a smile in so many of these scenes just because the writing is so good. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, I'm just enjoying these words coming out of these actors' mouths in these settings.
I'm actually kind of in shock right now. You subverted my expectations, because I was so ready for you to be like, yep, the editor was great. Yep, Freddie Young, cinematography, wow, amazing. Yep, Bolt, Wilson, yep, sure, the writing, brilliant. Peter O'Toole, wow, incredible. But you got to give us David Lean, and I was so ready for that. What is it about, like, yes, like, they are so outstanding, but, I mean, David Lean's direction here, like being able to pull it all together, and the intensity of that shoot particularly must have been,
yeah,
I mean, he'd be worthy as
absolutely.
Well, wouldn't he?
And I'm kind of, you know, as an Oscar nerd, I'm sure you'll appreciate this, I'm pulling a little bit of a cheat here. I'm kind of allowing the acclaim for the movie as a whole, which it has received and will continue to, I'm kind of letting that stand in as the accolade for David Lean. Like, that's kind of his recognition, is the fact that this movie is so great. But in terms of the individual components that I want to call out that make it great, I think the cinematography gets called out often enough. I think Peter O'Toole gets recognized often enough, maybe not by the Academy. but I don't think when people talk about how great this movie is, enough attention is given to the writing and the editing. And that's why I wanted to recognize both of those as the kind of MVP, as my MVP when talking about this movie today.
You basically took the idea out of my head, because that is where I was leading, and I was going to go with Andy Coates as editor for my MVP, just because obviously very influential, the incredible task that it would have been pulling it together on film. We often talk about who is responsible for things like tone, for things like pacing. And this movie is long, but it's never boring. It's never slow. There's a lot happening. It's even things like, I think back to right at the start of the movie with Lawrence and the guide at the well. And then the guide just stops and just looks.
Yeah.
And then we see like a hazy horizon, like nothing really. We got no idea what he's looking at, but it must be something, right? And it's that level of manipulation of your audience, really, that is the sign of an expert editor. And that scene itself, it's probably like a minute. It feels like about a minute until we actually realize that, okay, this is definitely a person. This is definitely a person approaching. This person is a threat. Although we kind of already know that they're a threat. Whatever it is, it's a threat. But we can't see. But we know it's bad, and we know what's happening. And it's building, and then, you know, shot in the head before we even see who it actually is. That is just a small slice of why the editing is just so, so impressive, I think.
Yeah, and that's, you can't talk about that sequence without talking about the cinematography, too. And and David Lean's recognition that this was going to work in the first place, because there was no guarantee that this would. A lot of times they didn't know that some of the stuff they were doing was working until they got the film developed, and then it was, you know, kind of too late to do anything about it. And one of the things that I didn't really realize and appreciate until I got to see this movie in theaters, and now you can kind of see it on the latest, you know, kind of like 4K disc release on a nice big screen, you can see this. But, you know, when Ali first appears, you know, you say at first, you know, it cuts back and it's like he's looking out at nothing, but you can see that like tiniest little black dot in the distance. Mm-hmm. That first time that it shows the shimmering horizon, you can see this little tiny dot, and the fact that they pulled that off is just it's a magic trick. It's incredible, and you kind of don't even believe that you're seeing it the first time you see it, especially in a theater.
I love that you've called back to film's origins, really, calling it a magic trick, because that's what film was initially. It was used for vaudevillian magic tricks a lot of the time. It's like there's little parts of this movie where you're just like, how? Or even if it's not how, it's just like, whoa. And as I said, like that first shot of Peter O'Toole's Lawrence walking to his motorbike and kind of like, you know, setting it up ready to ride it. That's just an amazing shot to me. It throws you off too, though, because it's like slightly off kilter, slightly off. I don't know, man. I could go on about this movie forever. I just don't have the time, unfortunately, but I wish I could keep talking about it. Let's talk about favorite moments, favorite lines, favorite scenes. Do you have a favorite character? I assume your favorite performance is probably Peter O'Toole's, but yeah, throw some favorites at me. And I know that it's one of your favorite movies, so
yeah, why is that? It's hard to pick, especially when there are so many minutes from which to choose. The scene, you know, it's an obvious one, but one for a reason. The scene where Ali is being introduced, that approach to the well, that whole sequence is mesmerizing. Mm-hmm. The scene where Lawrence comes back to Cairo and he's reporting that they've taken Aqaba, something that, you know, didn't happen in real life, but, you know, it's this memorable journey in the movie. And he arrives with one of his young companions, the only one who survived the journey. And, you know, he kind of, the all these stuffy British officers are like, you know, you're in rags and you've got this dirty Arab here. What are you doing? Like, you can't be in here. Like, you know, all these assholes are, you know, don't want them there. Don't want to serve them. And, you know, Lawrence doesn't give a shit. Just, you know, like says, nope, we're going to have two lemonades, you know, and the way he says they're for him, and his voice kind of breaks, and he's so overwhelmed with emotion after this journey. That moment always really moves me. And I'd say, you know, towards the end, the complete, when he's charging against the Turks when they don't need to, you know, Ali is asking, begging him not to do this. They don't need to do this. And Lawrence,
no prisoners.
He's feeling the bloodlust, you know, his need for vengeance is too much, and he's kind of lost his soul at this point in the story. That moment too always really kind of affects me, and there's so many, you know. Yeah. But those are a few that stand out right now. I'm sure if you asked me in another 6 months or a year, I'd have a different answer.
I think my favorite thing is kind of a combination of a few of those things. It's watching and being able to chart the decline of his mental state, from where he goes from, you know, like right from the start, just being like, you know, putting out the match with his fingers and being like, you have to be okay with the pain. That's the secret, right? And then, you know, he gets shot in the arm later in the movie, like after a whole bunch of events, and he just stands there and almost kind of dares the person to shoot again and to actually hit him this time, like properly. Right. Because you've got to be okay with the pain. You've got to be okay with, you know, and the way that he, you know, he feels guilty about, you know, like Daoud dying or Farage as well later in the movie. And he sort of pays penance with all these little moments, like he's walking beside the camel. He's, you know, because you have to be okay with the pain. You have to be okay with it, you know, and he continues to go down to the point where he gets tortured and, you know, debatably raped. It appears to be raped at this one point, which further breaks his psyche. And then they still get to Damascus first. And it's for nothing because they don't know what they're doing when they get there. And he's in this big palatial city and it feels huge, and he feels alone. He feels small in this huge city because all of this superhuman achievement has been for naught. I love that. I love that they really, really nailed that tone.
Yeah. Yeah. The triumph that quickly turns bittersweet. You know, certainly the first time I watched this movie and I didn't know really any of the story, I was surprised by that turn. I was sort of, you know, programmed a bit as a young movie watcher to kind of expect there to be this sense of achievement and great, we did it, and we're we accomplish the goal and we beat those dastardly British to the city and we did the thing we said we were going to do, and then pretty quickly just falls apart.
And then you loop it back to the, you know, the start of the movie, which is his death. And he's been, you know, entombed in like St. Paul's Cathedral, which is a big deal in England. And, you know, this guy is a hero. He's a national hero. Like 20 years after the war, they're still talking about him. And it's you know, this big, big deal that this guy has died. But then by the end of the movie, you realize that, I mean, he was made colonel so they could get rid of him. You know, he was made colonel so that he would be stationed back home, away from where he was in the way, where he was a nuisance to the British Empire. They made him a hero through propaganda, kind of almost, with the influence of that Bentley character in the media. They made him a hero because he's the hero that Britain needed during these war times. Kind of like Harvey Dent in The Dark Knight, right? Like, it's like, you know, like, yeah, I mean, you did some shitty
things. They certainly tried to. In this part of my history might be a little muddy. He either turned down a knighthood or some big, medal or something, yeah, or both, you know, yeah, because he didn't appreciate the imperial ambitions of the British government, particularly in the Middle East, because he was pro, you know, like that part of his character in the movie seems to be like more or less consistent with real life, in that he genuinely liked these people and thought that they should not be under either Turkish imperial rule, which is what they were under before, or British or French or anyone's.
Mm-hmm. And you're right, I had heard that. It's that he, apparently he was summoned by the king. He realized that there was like, okay, the king's there, there's a little cushion to kneel on, there's a sword, I'm getting knighted. It's probably something that he's always wanted because he loved knights and lords and all that sort of stuff as a kid growing up. And then he turned around and walked out the door, apparently.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I've heard, and that's pretty badass.
That's pretty badass, right?
That's awesome. But, you know, that's the kind of story that the king and the propaganda arm of the royal family are not going to be promoting. They're not going to talk about that. They're going to talk about, you know, his heroic deeds during the war. He's the hero that Britain needed. And that's something that I found really fascinating. So I love that about the movie. I think it's my favorite element of the movie, for sure. Ian Buckley, is there anything else you want to talk about before we get into plugging podcasts?
I'm sure there's plenty more we could. Maybe we will at some point down the road in the future. But for now, I think that pretty well covers it. In case anyone couldn't tell, I recommend they watch this movie.
I do too, and yeah. If there's anything left unsaid, let's save it for the 70th anniversary in 10 years' time. Ian Buckley, it's been a pleasure as always. Where can anybody who has enjoyed your insights, I'm sure they have, where else can they find you in the podcasting world?
Yeah, so you can hear me elsewhere on the We Made This Network. I am on We Are Starfleet, our Star Trek Discovery and Strange New Worlds podcast. Pop up on Rarely Going, our animated Star Trek podcast, The Way, our Star Wars podcast, as well as right here on Movieversaries with you. I'm on a bunch of these, so you'll hear me not just on this episode, but on future episodes.
Yeah, which we should... I think The Thing, that's our next one, right? We had to get Lawrence of Arabia done, but The Thing. Have you managed to catch that in the cinema yet?
Oh, I mean, I have in my life. Not recently. I have not seen The Thing again. I think it's showing later this September, but I will have to double check.
We'll definitely keep an eye on that because I am very keen. Again, that's another one that's a big blind spot for me. So I've got to watch that one.
Oh, yeah. It's great. It's one of those weird movies that didn't get a lot of critical acclaim at the time. And I have no idea why. It's a blast.
Well, without saying it, I would say that it's because it came out the same year as Blade Runner. E.T., you know, like there's a whole bunch of like these really fantastic movies that come out in 1982. And The Thing was just kind of one of them, right? Yeah. And it's one that I haven't seen. So I guess I'm looking forward to that one. But until then, Ian, as always, mate, thank you so much for your time and for fitting me into your Wednesday afternoon.
Thanks. Pleasure as always.
Don't forget to subscribe to Movieversaries and give us a rating and a review wherever you can. You can find my other podcasts and the work of my wonderful guests by checking out the links in the show notes, where you'll also find the credits for this episode. Movieversaries is a product of the We Made This podcast network. And if you've enjoyed this, there's a good chance you'll enjoy a bunch of our other shows, which you'll get a preview of in just a moment. If you want to help out our network, please consider supporting us on Patreon by visiting patreon.com/wemadethis. Thanks for your company. This has been Movieversaries.
Hello, and this is Frame to Frame, part of the We Made This podcast network. We are a podcast that take two seemingly unconnected films and slam them together with the most obscure theme that we can find. I'm Andy Williams.
And I'm Sean Wilson.
And every Wednesday, you'll be able to find out a little bit more about the different themes and different films that we look into. You can hear moments such as this.
Gwyneth Paltrow has as many Oscars as David Cronenberg. That's just wrong in every sense of the word.
Yeah, but you can't get a candle that smells like David Cronenberg's. No, wait, I'm not going to go there.
No, don't do that.
I mean, we've done nearly 10 minutes on why you dislike Zack Snyder, and that was just the first person that I mentioned as a talented name.
You've got to take us in a positive direction, please.
Okay. Jared Butler is the lead of this film.
Oh, that's not a good start. that's really not a good start at all. Keep going. I just want to say, I really love your philosophy about no matter how good or bad a movie is, there's a lot of effort that goes into it. I really like that philosophy because I find myself grappling with that. It's kind of like it's really easy to tear something down because the finished product that comes out in the cinema or on streaming is nominally bad, but it has actually had a fair amount of effort that went into it, regardless exactly. of how that's translated.
Be sure to check your podcast app of choice every Wednesday to find new episodes. You'll be able to like, subscribe, and find us on social media at Frame to Frame Pod.